This is the Healthy Living Podcast from OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. OWL Radio broadcasts to homes in San Antonio, the Hill Country, San Antonio Methodist Hospitals, and via online streaming and smartphone access. You can also ask your Alexa device to enable and play OWL Radio. Welcome. I am Martha Attee, and I'll be reading today from the Nutrition Action Newsletter. The topic will be Gut Reaction. 6 Common Questions About Gastrointestinal Health. 5 to 10% of Americans suffer from irritable bowel syndrome. Half of people over 60 have diverticulosis. About a quarter of us lack the enzyme that digests lactose. And we all deal with occasional gas, constipation, bloating, and indigestion. Here is the scoop on 6 common questions about gut health. Number 1. Does fiber or fermented foods enhance your microbiota? According to Goop.com, quote, what's uncomplicated and pretty much indisputable at this point is that working live cultures into your diet can be an asset. Regularly eating fermented foods, such as yogurt, kefir, sauerkraut, and kimchi, can help support a healthy gut. Well, is it really indisputable? Not quite. Fermented foods are made by combining milk, vegetables, and other ingredients with yeast or bacteria. Until last year, few well-designed studies had put fermented foods to the test. Christopher Gardner, professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine, said, I ran this study with my colleagues, Justin and Erica Sonnenberg, who just wanted to look at fiber. Their studies on mice had shown that fiber was king for improving microbial diversity. Low microbial diversity has been linked to a higher risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, and more, though something else about people with a narrow range of bacteria in their gut could explain their higher risk. But what I said is that the world seems convinced that we need both fiber and fermented foods, and wouldn't it be good if we compared them? So Gardner and his team randomly assigned 36 healthy adults to eat a diet high in fiber or a diet high in fermented foods. The fiber group's goal: eat 20 or more grams a day of fiber than they did before they entered the study. Gardner said, we asked them to eat as many beans, vegetables, fruits, and whole grains as they could. The fermented group's goal was eat 6 servings of fermented foods every day. For instance, a cup of kimchi or sauerkraut is 2 servings. A bottle of kombucha that you buy at the store is about 2.5 servings, and 6 ounces of yogurt is 1 serving. It is a lot, but it's doable. After 10 weeks, microbial diversity increased in the fermented food eaters, but didn't change in the fiber eaters. Why would fiber boost microbial diversity? In theory, gut bacteria gobble up some types of fiber as food, allowing them to multiply. But that didn't happen. Gardner says, we looked at the fermentable fibers in stool samples. If you eat this fiber, and your microbes use it as fuel, you shouldn't see the fiber in the stool. But we saw a lot of fiber in the stool of some of the volunteers, so those people don't seem to have the microbes to deal with the extra fiber. Those were exploratory outcomes. That means they were unplanned. So they need to be confirmed in a future study. It's also possible that the study didn't last long enough to see the effect of fiber on the microbiome. Another surprise, the vast majority of the new bacteria in the volunteers' guts didn't come from their food. We bought the products that the study participants were eating and cataloged their bacteria, says Gardner. Only 5% of the new bacteria in the volunteers' guts matched the foods they were eating. So where did the new gut bacteria come from? That's a bigger surprise that we can't explain, says Gardner. Maybe the increase in diversity was coming from some bacteria that were at sub-detectable levels at the beginning of the study. Maybe we changed the environment of the gut and all of a sudden the other bacteria bloomed. But it wasn't from the yogurt, and it wasn't from the kimchi. It was something else. Gardner isn't encouraging people to revamp their diets based on his findings. For one thing, we need evidence that microbial diversity actually lowers the risk of chronic disease. Gardner's bottom line is, these results are exciting. They've generated new questions for what to look into next. He says, we don't yet have our heads wrapped around how diet influences the microbiome and what that means for health. The second question, can you become more tolerant of lactose? 3/4 of the world's population and about 1/4 of the United States population loses its ability to digest the milk sugar lactose after weaning. So says Dennis Savaiano, professor of nutrition at Purdue University. In those people, the gene that tells the body to produce lactase turns off over time. Lactase is the enzyme that breaks down lactose into glucose and galactose, which then can be absorbed into the bloodstream. As a result, they end up losing about 95% of the lactase in their gut. So intact lactose makes its way to the colon, where it gets fermented by bacteria. The fermentation releases gases and draws water into the colon, which can cause the stomach cramping, diarrhea, and flatulence in some people. But just because you are a lactose maldigester, that is, you've lost most of your ability to break down lactose, doesn't mean you need to avoid dairy forever. For starters, many dairy foods, like hard cheeses, don't have much lactose, just 1 gram or so per serving. What's more, most people can tolerate far more lactose than they realize, says Saviano. I'm a maldigester, he says. If I were to have, say, 2 glasses of milk on an empty stomach, I would get symptoms. But if I were to have 1 cup of milk in my oatmeal, I probably wouldn't notice it. That's because both the amount of lactose and the speed at which it moves through the gut influence the symptoms people get. If you have milk with other food, you're slowing its transit through the intestine, and that helps your body digest more of it. Saviano did a blinded study on lactose maldigesters where they showed that most people can have about 12 grams of lactose, the amount in 1 cup of milk, without getting symptoms. Now on to yogurt. Yogurt bacteria have a very high level of the lactase enzyme. Saviano says the enzyme becomes active in the intestine, where it breaks down the yogurt's lactose. It turns out that eating yogurt is like eating a lactase pill with a glass of milk. Most surprisingly, Saviano has shown that people can turn their intolerance into tolerance. In one study, we adapted people slowly by giving them increasing amounts of lactose in water with their meals. After 10 days, they were able to consume 70 grams of lactose a day. That is a lot of lactose. It's the equivalent of nearly 6 cups of milk. Did the maldigesters start producing more lactase enzyme? No. The bacteria in their gut rose to the challenge by digesting the excess lactose. Saviano says, if you want to try it, please start with a small amount, maybe 1/4 cup of milk with breakfast. If you can tolerate that for a few days, then slowly you can go up. At some point, you might exceed the capacity of the gut to adapt, and you'll get symptoms. The next problem with guts. Number 3, do you need digestive enzyme supplements? Quote, after the age of 20, your body starts producing fewer enzymes, which can make digesting certain foods harder, leading to stomach woes. So says the website of ZenWise, a popular source of digestive enzyme supplements on Amazon. It goes on to say, replenishing those digestive enzymes can help you enjoy digestive delight. Well, it's probably just helping ZenWise's bottom line, more like it. Our bodies make digestive enzymes that break down food into nutrients that we can absorb. Kyle Staller, director of the Gastrointestinal Motility Laboratory at Massachusetts General Hospital, says, the enzymes are secreted by the digestive tract, starting in the mouth, but most digestive enzymes come from the pancreas. This idea that we all have low digestive enzyme deficiency, or that we could benefit from a little boost, does not fit with our understanding of how the pancreas or enzymes work. You need to have a loss of almost 90% of pancreatic enzymes to have a GI effects that you would notice. The pancreas is very resilient, and there's really no evidence that we produce fewer digestive enzymes as we age. What's more, Staller says, so many of the symptoms that these enzyme supplements claim to treat are common and could be caused by a slew of different conditions. To claim that they are all the result of low digestive enzymes is being disingenuous. The only exceptions, people who have diagnosed pancreatic insufficiency or those with lactose intolerance. Lactase pills are there and they work for lactose intolerance, says Saviano. Make sure to take them with your milk. The fourth question about gut health. Does slashing FODMAPs cure irritable bowel syndrome? First of all, what is FODMAP? And that is spelled FODMAP, and it's all in capital letters. It is the acronym that stands for fermentable, for the F, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. This acronym, FODMAP, F-O-D-M-A-P, is a fancy way of describing sugars that your small intestine may have trouble digesting and absorbing. William Che, professor of gastroenterology at the University of Michigan, says, Irritable bowel syndrome is a symptom-based condition. Everybody with IBS has abdominal pain and altered bowel habits. That typically means diarrhea, constipation, or both. Irritable bowel syndrome is a really common issue. Probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of the United States population suffers from it. Doctors don't know what causes IBS, and there are no surefire treatments. But the vast majority of IBS patients link their symptoms to eating food. It's not only people with IBS. If anybody eats enough of the FODMAPs, FODMAPs, they will get to your colon and be fermented by bacteria, producing gas and drawing in fluid, which can cause diarrhea. Of course, enough may mean a huge dose for most people, so they don't have to worry. But people with irritable bowel have issues with motility and gut hypersensitivity, so they are more prone to develop symptoms from small doses of the FODMAPs. FODMAPs occur in a wide range of foods, and different FODMAPs affect people differently. For example, in irritable bowel patients, fructans are probably the most common trigger for symptoms. Says Che, fructans are oligosaccharides made of short change of the fructose molecules. Wheat and onions are the top contributors of fructans in a typical diet. When patients with irritable bowel syndrome eliminate wheat from their diet and get better, they often assume that it was from restricting gluten. But evidence suggests that they get a better response from the restriction of fructans instead of gluten. To figure out which FODMAPs, if any, trigger your symptoms, you have to follow a low FODMAP diet. We recommend that people remove FODMAP for 2 weeks to 6 weeks. That restriction period determines whether an individual is sensitive to FODMAPs or not. After 6 weeks, if symptoms have improved, a low FODMAP diet isn't going to work. So, finding your FODMAPs. This list that I'm about to read, it doesn't include all foods or food ingredients with FODMAPs. For a thorough list or help following a low FODMAP diet, you should visit mygnutrition.com. That's mygnutrition.com. All right, for the oligosaccharides, the foods are onions, garlic, wheat, rye, barley, beans, lentils, chickpeas, asparagus, broccoli, cashews, and chicory root. In the disaccharides, lactose are milk, cottage cheese, ricotta, and ice cream. In the monosaccharides are honey, agave syrup, apples, mangoes, cherries, pears, watermelon, and high fructose corn syrup. And the polyols are sorbitol, maltitol, xylitol, peaches, plums, prunes, blackberries, mushrooms, and celery. How effective is a low FODMAP diet? In one of the best studies, researchers randomly assigned 87 adults with IBS to follow this low FODMAP diet. In other words, the sugars that affect your small intestine. After 4 weeks, roughly 60% of those on the low FODMAP diet versus about 40% of those on the placebo diet reported adequate symptom relief. For those whose symptoms do improve on FODMAP restrictions, then they can go on to the second phase of the diet plan, which is a slow, methodical reintroduction of foods containing individual FODMAPs. That lets people go back to eating foods that cause no symptoms. About 75% of people who start the very low FODMAP diet move to the less restrictive version, says Dr. Che. Restriction is the beginning, not the end of the diet. What matters is whether the cumulative dose for the individual food maps crosses a threshold that triggers symptoms. It's a low FODMAP diet, not a no FODMAP diet, says Che. That's where trained dietitians can help. They understand the hurdles that trip people up and can help you identify what is triggering your symptoms. Just to be clear, this low FODMAP diet isn't a miracle cure. The good news is 50 to 60% of patients get better, which is really good for IBS treatments. The bad news, 40 to 50% of the patients don't. We should not be satisfied that we have the solution, Che argues. I'm hoping this will open the gates for the discovery of other effective diet therapies for IBS. The fifth question about GI health: should you avoid nuts and popcorn if you have diverticulitis? Diverticulosis happens when the lining of the colon pokes through the muscles on the outside of the colon, causing these pockets that look like indentations. So says Lisa Stray, head of gastroenterology at Harborview Medical Center at the University of Washington. And while diverticulosis is common, it's mostly inconsequential. At least 50% of us will get it as we age, but diverticulosis itself is asymptomatic. Fewer than 5 in 100 patients will ever have a problem. However, diverticulitis is a different animal. That's where one or a couple of the pockets get inflamed. And diverticulitis can result in pain in the lower abdomen, constipation, or diarrhea. Who is at risk for diverticulosis? It is estimated that approximately 50% of a person's risk is genetic. But lifestyle factors also matter. People who aren't physically active, those with obesity, smokers, and those who take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are all most likely to get diverticulitis. Diet plays a role as well. People that eat a Western diet, which is high in red meat, refined grains, and high-fat dairy, are much more likely to get diverticulitis than those who eat a diet that is rich in fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and low in red meat. If you do have diverticulitis, one thing you don't have to worry about avoiding is nuts, seeds, and popcorn. That seems to be a bit of folklore, says Dr. Strait. When you look at the colons of people with diverticulosis, there are little balls of stool that get stuck in these pockets. It was assumed that nuts, seeds, and popcorn were likely to get stuck and cause trauma. However, Dr. Strait followed roughly 47,000 men for 18 years. We actually found that the risk for diverticulitis was lower, not higher, in those who ate lots of nuts and popcorn. That kind of study can't prove that eating nuts and popcorn lowers risks. Something else about people who eat those foods may explain their lower risk. The doctor says, we hope that in the near future there will be randomized trials that more rigorously test how diet impacts the likelihood of developing diverticulitis. So stay tuned. And now the final question about GI health, number 6. Does chewing curb GI discomfort? One common piece of advice is to chew your food an estimated 32 times before swallowing, according to Healthline.com. Not chewing, Healthline claims, can result in bloating, diarrhea, acid reflux, nausea, and more. Why is 32 bites the magic number? Healthline.com doesn't say. While no studies have tested whether chewing each bite thoroughly, much less 32 times, prevents GI discomfort, there is a reason to make sure you chew your food sufficiently. Chewing your food thoroughly makes it easier for your stomach to process the food, so explains the University of Michigan's William Che. The stomach helps to prepare food to be digested in the small bowel by grinding it up, killing most of the bacteria, and liquefying it. The smaller the pieces of the food, the easier the job for the stomach. What's more, Che says, swallowing big chunks of food is likely to make you swallow more air, which can cause bloating and belching. Beyond that common sense advice, there's no evidence that a specific number of chews eases your GI problems. That's the end of that article, but I have a quick study, a snapshot of the latest research on diet, exercise, and more. Colonoscopy. Do not wait. Women who had a screening colonoscopy or sigmoidoscopy before the age 50 had about a 55% lower risk of colorectal cancer by age 55 than those who had neither. So what should you do? You should get screened, starting at age 45, as the American Cancer Society and others now recommend. For more on screening for all cancers, go to cancer.org/healthy/find-cancer-early. Or you can go to cdc.gov/cancer. And finally, does fast food lead to unhealthy visceral belly fat? Researchers tracked 3,156 young adults for 25 years. The more often they ate fast food, the higher their visceral fat, whether or not they had obesity. And those who ate fast food at least 3 times a week had roughly 5 times the risk of metabolic-associated fatty liver disease compared to those who ate fast food no more than once a month. So what you should do is limit your fast food fare. This kind of study can't prove that the fast food creates more visceral or liver fat. The scientists accounted for many factors, but something else about fast food eaters could explain the results. However, cheeseburgers, fries, and shakes are a far cry from a healthy eating plan. You have been listening to Healthy Living. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, please call 210-829-4223. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Martha Atee. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye from OWL Radio.